You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Jeff Chang is a journalist, cultural critic, and head of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford. In his new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America, he argues that the myth of multiculturalism has in some ways silenced a real conversation about racial disparity in America.
We're in a culturally desegregated world, right? Diddy's a superstar. Jay-Z and Beyonce are everywhere. Everybody agrees with me that they're amazing, you know? Well, maybe not everybody, but you know. And yet, at the same time, you can still have a Michael Brown, a Trayvon Martin, a Tamir Rice, and Eric Garner happen.
KALW's Sandhya Dirks sat down with Chang to talk about his new book, Current Protests Over Police Shootings, and how to begin a conversation about race in America today.
In so many ways, this is a book about sort of the myth of the post-racial world,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if in the current events that we're seeing right now, we're kind of watching that myth just come crashing down in a really real way.
It feels weird to even use the word post-racial. Like, certainly nobody believes that anymore. If there are any people who are hanging on to that notion, they've lost their grasp on that. And the post-racial notion, in some ways, was an updated version of, let's all be colorblind now. Everything's good now. It's all great. But now that we can see the gaps, not just between the ideal of colorblindness or the end of colorblindness, if it's not your ideal, and the reality, and even between where our president chooses to stand and where the protesters and demonstrators choose to stand. We could see the gaps opening up there. I think it's impossible for us not to come to a point of questioning. What I fear the most is that we move through this period and come to a new way of redefining colorblindness such that we have to deal with this again.
That we do it all over again.
In my children's generation, yeah. I mean, you know, look at like the race riots of the 60s. And we come back around to the race riots of the 80s, you know, 1992, the Los Angeles riots. And now this spate of, you know, police killings that show us that the ways in which we see race actually haven't necessarily changed that much.
One of the things I found so interesting about reading this was sort of the analysis that you did of pop culture, advertisement, sort of everything that surrounds us in terms of media and the way that it works to help perpetuate that sort of the post-racial myth over and over and over again, preventing us, in a sense, from ever actually confronting the lack of that.
Yeah, the book really is about artists and the way that they can literally change the way that we see. And I came in like really wanting to kind of express that. The kind of culmination of that is this sort of slogan that me and a lot of folks, for lack of a better word, kind of have come up with, which is that cultural change precedes political change. Like, if you can't see it in the culture, it's definitely not going to be happening up in Congress. And so, you know, you had to see Jackie Robinson on the baseball field before you can even imagine a Brown versus Board of Education decision. You had to see Ellen DeGeneres on TV before you can even imagine same-sex marriage being a thing.
If art is this key, how do we wield it to make it different for your children's generation?
Well, I think we wield it fiercely, and we continue to be really about looking at what is lacking and what we need to kind of reveal, right? And to give you some examples, let me give you some hard examples because we've been talking kind of abstractly.
I love hard examples.
Hard examples. So, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. goes up and gives this speech in Washington in 1963, March on Washington. He says all these things, and one of the things he says is we should be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin. And it's this that the conservatives seize in the 1970s and the 1980s to say, let's talk about putting colorblindness into the law so that we can reverse all of these, you know, changes that have been made because of civil rights legislation that was passed, right? And so colorblindness in the 80s becomes a way of reacting against and tearing down this infrastructure of policies and laws that have been put into place to transform America. And so what you get is the ultimate outcome of it is Ward Connerly in California, you know, sponsoring an equal opportunity initiative that's designed to get rid of affirmative action in the state of California, that everybody should be treated equally under the law, including privileged whites. Whereas that was never the intention. That was exactly, it was actually the exact opposite. It was to remedy racial discrimination. So that, right? And then even with the notion of multiculturalism, it was a radical idea that Ishmael Reed kind of put into circulation with the word multiculture in 1975 in the Berkeley Barb. And it was meant to say that there are other ways of being in the U.S., other ways of becoming American that that don't involve having to assimilate into a white, suburban, sort of WASPy ideal. There are all these different types of ways, and we've always been a country of many, many cultures. It was a radical idea because at that time it was assumed that America can only be one kind of culture. It had to be a unitary type of thing. If you weren't going to assimilate, then the country was going to fall apart. And so it was a radical idea at the time. And I think what you see is by the time you get to the turn of the millennium, you know, and afterwards, George W. Bush is now appointing Alberto Gonzalez and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell in the name of diversity. And so multiculturalism now has sort of a culturally conservative analog. And that's as a way, of figuring out how to maintain the status quo, even if you got to give out a couple of positions here. And every time there's a change, there's an equal pushback. And that's where the culture wars, I think, come from.
What are the things about race that we're still afraid to talk about?
We're afraid to talk about injustice, inequality, discrimination, and privilege, and not necessarily in that order, maybe even in reverse order. We're certainly like not anxious to start a conversation about our own privilege and what that entails, because that would require possibly us, definitely us, giving up some of that privilege, right?
And being implicated.
And being implicated in this, right? And, you know, that may shine a light on things that we don't want to examine. You know, the race conversation is something that's really interesting. At this particular point, right now, right in the middle of it all, we can't avoid it. But are we having the kinds of conversations and are people hearing and joining the conversations where they need to be? What we saw happening, I think, after Ferguson was that there were a number of polls that showed that there's not just a growing resegregation, racial resegregation in schools, in housing,
in income,
in wealth, in home ownership, in educational attainment, and all those kinds of things. There's also a gap in the way that we talk about this. So that, you know, the polls asked, is Ferguson opening up an opportunity for us to be able to talk about issues that need to be talked about around race? Blacks overwhelmingly said yes. Whites, not so much. They were on the other side of the spectrum. So the other side of the question was, are the events in Ferguson casting too much attention on race? And not a majority, but a plurality of whites, a large plurality of whites said yes. Like, we're talking about it too much. So we can't even, one group's invitation to join a conversation is another group's invitation to say, okay, see ya, I'm out the door. Can we even get into the same room around this? But we need to. We haven't had a consensus around racial justice since 1965. And that's why we've gone backwards on all these things. And that's why we have these repercussions and reproductions and sort of reverberations every generation of explosive moments that point to all of these wounds that haven't been healed. And so at this particular moment, I think that we need to engage in that particular conversation. We need to see people talking about disparities in policing, in incarceration, in containment. We need to be talking about resegregation. Gentrification is only part of resegregation. It's the part that you see in the city. So it's gotten a lot of attention because there's a lot of people in the city that can talk about gentrification. That's what's happening into their neighborhoods. But where do people go? That's the other part of it. That's the other part of resegregation. And
it's reverse white flight. I mean,
it's reverse white flight.
The greatest change in migration in American cities.
But what I'm saying is in this debate that we're having here in the San Francisco Bay Area around gentrification, we don't talk about the people who have been displaced, and we don't hear from the people who have been displaced. We're hearing from the people who are afraid of being displaced, who are a very important part of the discussion. But what about the people who have been displaced? And so what I'm saying is in order for us to have a true conversation about it, it needs to be a regional conversation about it. People are being forced into the aging suburbs, such as Ferguson, such as Sanford, where policing is really the only governmental service that's growing. And so let's talk about that.
That was Jeff Chang, head of Stanford's Institute for Diversity in the Arts, speaking with KALW's Sandhya Dirks.